Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Rebecca Robinson, a Commonwealth Club volunteer and moderator for this evening's program, which was organized by the Humanities Forum. We also welcome our listening audience, both on the radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It is my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Laura Ackley. Laura Ackley holds graduate degrees from the Harvard University Graduate School of Design and the University of California at Berkeley College of Environmental Design, as well as an undergraduate degree in architecture from Berkeley. Her interest in the Panama Pacific International Exposition was captured by a cultural landscapes course during her undergraduate years. She has worked for such diverse firms as Lucasfilm, Bechtel Engineering, and Autodesk, and taught 3D computer modeling for more than a decade. Her book, San Francisco's Jewel City, The Panama Pacific International Exposition of 1915, co-published by Heyday and the California Historical Society, was awarded a gold medal at the 2015 California Book Awards, sponsored by the Commonwealth Club. While Laura's talk will focus specifically on the design elements of the fair, this is but a tiny fraction of what she explores in her book. The book includes the Midway, music, famous and infamous visitors, and groundbreaking new technology introduced at the fair. Without further ado, please welcome Laura Ackley.
All right, we're going to check the microphone volume right now. George, can you hear me back there? Anyone hard of hearing have trouble hearing me back there? All right, great. Welcome to Design, Color, and Light at the Panama Pacific International Exposition. First of all, I'd like to thank the Commonwealth Club for inviting me to speak today. So the reason that I'm giving this particular talk, Design, Color, and Light, was inspired by this tome, The Transactions of the Commonwealth Club, Volume 10, 1915 to 1916. In one of their summer editions in 1915, they stressed exposition architecture. Now, while I do not have the luxury of having Bernard Maybeck and Willis Polk to speak live, I do have 100 years of hindsight. And so this is kind of a commemorative lecture based on the Commonwealth Club's very important article of 100 years ago this summer. I consider the Panama Pacific International Exposition, which I will call the PPIE for both brevity and sanity's sake, as the last great World's Fair of the Classic Era, and the story of its various design elements is fascinating. This evening, I'll take you on a tour of the history behind and the final realization of those designs. Our story actually begins on Christmas Day, 1891, when the San Francisco Examiner published an article, 1900, let the next great World's Fair be held in San Francisco. The proposal was clearly intended to upstage the approaching Chicago Columbian Exposition of 1893. But the Examiner described, quote, a feasible plan to commemorate the achievements and triumphs of the 19th century. The concept was illustrated by a young architect named Willis Polk with images of a 1,000-foot tower surrounded by Spanish Renaissance exposition buildings. Now, really, this idea was never seriously considered, but keep this image in mind as we go on with our discussion of the design of our 1915 fair. The architectural climate in the 1890s was strongly influenced by the Beaux-Arts style, a codification of the urban renewal programs undertaken in Paris between 1853 and 1870, when designer Georges Eugène Haussmann drove long straight boulevards through some of the most historic sections of the city and emphasized the resulting focal points with architecture and monuments. The 1893 World's Columbian Exposition, held in Chicago and planned by Daniel Burnham, was the first showcase of the urban planning precepts of the Beaux-Arts in America. And that fair's effects on American architecture was seismic. Many recognize that the neoclassical vision manifested in 1893 would have lasting consequences. Architect Louis Sullivan, who designed the most innovative building at the fair, the Transportation Palace, said, quote, "The damage wrought by the World's Fair will last for half a century from its date, if not longer. It has penetrated deep into the constitution of the American mind." And Louis Sullivan was right. In America, Beaux-Arts style took on a social component, too, when it was adopted by the City Beautiful movement, which sought social reform through urban improvements. The first grand Beaux-Arts scheme to influence the Bay Area's architecture was a competition held in the late 1890s for the design of the University of California at Berkeley campus, which was sponsored by the Hearst family matriarch, Phoebe Apperson Hearst. Architect Bernard Maybeck was dispatched to oversee the competition in Europe, where he spent most of 1897 and 1898. A plan created by the Frenchman Émile Bernard was selected, but quickly the actual design work was turned over to Californian John Galen Howard, who had been chosen as the runner-up. Howard altered the plan significantly, and while the current campus shows off Beaux-Arts underpinnings, its reality is augmented by more than a century of newer styles and is far more eclectic. Our next stop along the Beaux-Arts Trail was sponsored by the Association for the Improvement and Adornment of San Francisco. They tasked famed planner Daniel Burnham, who was the main designer of the 1893 fair, with developing a plan to beautify the city by the bay. His Report on a Plan for San Francisco was completed in September 1905 and featured a series of concentric rings radiating from the new Civic Center and sliced by axial boulevards. On the drawings, the diagonal roads were clearly visible, but the planned rings succumbed to the hilly geography and became almost indiscernible on the plans. The hills of San Francisco would be garnished with terraced parks and crowned by special monuments, an observatory on Telegraph Hill, a casino on Sutro Heights, and an Athenaeum on Twin Peaks. Whatever that is. A grand artery studded with parks and glades would girdle the waterfront all the way to the Presidio, while the panhandle of Golden Gate Park would be extended to east to Van Ness. Mission Street would be widened and connected to El Camino Real, heading down the peninsula. But on April 18th, the massive 7.8 magnitude great earthquake and fires quashed this ambitious scheme. While it might have seemed that the leveled downtown area might have facilitated the implementation of the Burnham Plan, it actually did exactly the opposite. James D. Phelan, the former mayor of San Francisco, who was chairman of the Association for the Adornment of San Francisco, wrote in 1918, quote, "The people dropped the ideal plan in order to house themselves and rehabilitate their affairs. It was the worst time to talk about beautification. The people were thrown back to a consideration as to how they would again live and thrive." Only a few bits and pieces of Burnhamesque features from the plan were ever implemented. You can see them in the Beaux-Arts grouping around the Civic Center Plaza, the widening of 19th Avenue and Geary Boulevards, and the new Romanesque wharves along the Embarcadero. Well, they were new in 1915. While Burnham's grandiose plan was fading, its legacy was waxing in a different dream city on the northern shore of San Francisco. Many of the men who had promoted the Burnham Plan were now in positions of power for the fledgling exposition. In 1911, Willis Polk, chairman of the Executive Architectural Council of the PPIE, suggested that Edward Bennett, who had assisted Daniel Burnham in the 1905 report, be retained to prepare an overall plan for the Jewel City. Bennett worked with the architects to create a block plan for the exposition, and the layout of its exhibit palaces differed significantly from previous large American World's Fairs. While those expositions at Chicago, Buffalo, and St. Louis had striven for a unified appearance, they still consisted of individual buildings set within the plan. At San Francisco, a system of palaces and courts was devised, in which the 8 central palaces that we see here were similar in plan, differing only in facade detail and surrounded by a 65-foot-tall wall with openings into grand courts, each designed by a different noted architect. And all of these architects had Beaux-Arts pedigrees, having either attended the Paris École des Beaux-Arts itself or apprenticed under one of the major practitioners of the style. Bay Area architect Vernon DeMars, who had been 7 years old during the PPIE, said of his predecessors, quote, "All of the architects talked the same language at the time. It was done in the Beaux-Arts, and they would never get a chance to build anything as big and stupendous as all this." Willis Polk said of the composition, "In general outline, facades and roofs are to blend together. It is to be one grand palace, as the Orientals build them, colonnade after colonnade, dome after dome, arch after arch, penetrated by avenues, flanked by gardens, and Aladdin's palace, facing the azure harbor and the mountains beyond." By Oriental, Polk betokened the Near East and Islamic-influenced architecture. The courts especially bore the imprint of Moorish Andalusia in southern Spain, where elaborate courtyard-focused complexes were built between the 8th and 15th centuries. The courts were outdoor rooms within fortress-like perimeter walls, and each was lined with colonnades or arcades, some overhung with ornamental galleries. Now, other cultures have created courtyard complexes, but the interconnected courts of the PPIE were the most evocative of the grand Spanish compounds, overlaid with the rigorous symmetry of the Beaux-Arts. Not only did the internally focused plan of elegant buildings around sublime courts suit the programmatic and climactic requirements of the PPIE, it was utterly appropriate geographically, as San Francisco lies at precisely the same latitude as southern Spain. Several small pavilions located along the south wall of the palace block were expressly Moorish, with multifoil cusped horseshoe arches like those of the Alhambra in Granada. The PPIE pavilions featured stylized vegetal column capitals, slender pillars, and intricate arches. Octagonal concession kiosks that dotted the broad avenues of the fair were fenestrated with pointed or horseshoe arches, and some were garnished with Moorish domes. Even the bandstand in the Court of the Universe featured Moorish detail. Orange trees, their neatly trimmed branches heavy with golden fruit, were arrayed in orderly rows about Mulgart's opulent court of ages, after the fashion of the Al-Jafariya, the forecourt of the great mosque of Cordoba, and the Patio de los Naranjos of the Seville Cathedral, the remnant of an earlier mosque complex. To assist in the illusion of Islamic Iberian grandeur, every court or colonnade included a water feature, many of them Moorish in execution. Long, slender channels with burbling jets lined the central axis of the court of the universe. Amid many fountains and many fountains included shallow bowls that overflowed into larger basins, a design often seen in the palaces of Andalusia. The largest exemplars of Moorish style at the PPIE were the misnamed Italian Towers. Chief of Architecture George Kellam guarded the opening of each of his courts of palms and of flowers with a pair of these towers, each 204 feet tall and 38 foot in plan, 38 feet square. The sides of the towers were decorated with a diamond pattern in pink tones called an arabesque, a colorful surface treatment common to Moorish architecture. Each set of these towers differed slightly from the other, but all four were loosely based on the Giralda Tower in Seville, Spain, a former Islamic minaret constructed in the late 12th century. The eight main palaces were all designed by William Faville of the San Francisco firm of Bliss and Faville. Faville brought to mind the splendors of Byzantium in the cross-in-square configuration of the domes and roofs of the PPIE. You can see this in the raised red cross gables here, their surfaces composed of crushed brick mixed with asbestos. The 60-foot tall foot wall surrounding the palaces was topped with actual tiles and given interest by pilasters, portals, and courtyard entrances. Now, in the 6th century, the scholar Procopius described Constantinople's most revered monument, the Hagia Sophia. He said its glittering dome, quote, does not appear to rest upon a solid foundation, but to cover the place beneath as though it were suspended from heaven by the fabled golden chain, unquote. In the PPIE palaces, each dome at the intersection of the cross aisles floated above a lambent halo cast by a ring of small arched windows around the drum below, evoking the basilicas of the vanished empire. But the achievement of the engineer was also clear in the fretwork of cross-braced trusses, the martial lines of dimensional lumber columns, and the finishes that were purely utilitarian, deliberately allowing the interiors to express the true nature of the construction. Let's take a tour around the perimeter of the palace block. The west side, facing the lagoon of the Palace of Fine Arts, featured these two 112-foot-high half-domes. Each contained a cast concrete fountain designed by William Faville, perhaps the first of these to use this technology. This one now resides in the Plaza Viña del Mar in Sausalito. On the north side, Faville chose to use plateresque style for the four portals in the north wall facing the bay. Plateresque is a flamboyant style named for its resemblance to Spanish silverwork. Originally, monumental gates like this interrupted the long elevation, but they were later scaled down. The wall was punctured by straight colonnades, each with a long pool that led to the three interior courts, and we can see one such opening into a court here. The entrances were still highly decorative, with niches holding knights and pirates, but they did not extend much higher than the walls. The east side, or Avenue of Progress, featured sober Renaissance-style gateways and pilasters topped with California bears holding shields. The wall on the south side, facing the city, was most complex. It faced the Avenue of Palms and was studded with interesting doorways and towers. For the main entrance to the Palace of Varied Industries, Faville had the sculptor Gustav Gerlach reinterpret the 16th century doorway of the Hospital de Santa Cruz in Toledo, Spain. And this whole long facade centered about the colonnades and great triumphal arch that supported the 435-foot-tall central tower. The exclamation point at the center of the exposition was the Tower of Jewels, designed by Thomas Hastings of Carrere and Hastings. At that 435 feet tall, or about 43 stories, it dominated the skyline, and you can imagine dropping a 43-story building into the marina today. Described by one writer as, quote, Italian Renaissance with Byzantine modifications designed to suggest an Aztec tower, it is no wonder that critics were ambivalent about the Tower of Jewels. Some loved it, while others found it too squat, too busy, or too frivolous. The confection of a building stepped back in seven tiers, culminating in a 17-foot diameter armillary sphere. The arched base was 120 square feet in plan and 152 feet high over a 110-foot-tall triumphal arch. And the whole building was framed in more than 1,400 tons of structural steel, one of the few buildings at the fair built of steel. But most memorable about the Tower of Jewels were the Nova gems that lined its cornices. Director of Illumination Walter Darcy Ryan ordered 102,000 of these 2-inch diameter Austrian glass jewels to be hung around the building. They came in colors diamond jonquil, emerald, aquamarine, ruby, and amethyst. Now, does anyone in this room own a Nova gem? Aha! We'll go to your house afterwards. Now, fortunately, little known fact, which allowed me to write the book, is that I have a time machine, and I brought a Nova gem today. So we don't really have good light on this because this is backlit, but this is an aquamarine one, and you can just imagine 102,000 of these. They were all mounted on hooks, which allowed them to move in the breezes during the day and glitter and scintillate. And then at night, they were hit by fabulous colored lights for an amazing effect. Beautiful case sets of these Nova gems were presented as gifts to visiting dignitaries during the fair. When people ask me, what is the ultimate PPIE collectible? I usually say this because I don't have one. Now we will delve into the open spaces of the palace block, the five great courtyards. As I mentioned, the courts of palms and of flowers were both designed by George Kellam. Though similar in size and Mediterranean style, the court of palms was held to be more Grecian and the court of flowers more Italian in nuance. Ben McComber, a journalist, said of the courts, quote, both are calm and peaceful spots to rest and dream in the sun. Here, summer first unfolds her robes, and here she longest tarries. Henry Bacon, whose Lincoln Memorial was being constructed at the same time as the PPIE, designed the Court of Four Seasons. This court was actually 340 feet square, but the architect chamfered its corners using 45-degree colonnades, creating screens, behind each of which was a fountain and a statue representing a season of the year, designed by Furio Piccarilli. The goddess Ceres presided over its long northern peristyle. The great central court of the PPIE was the Court of the Universe, and it was inspired by Bernini's massive oval piazza at St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. It measured more than 700 feet wide and 520 feet deep and it was designed by McKim Mead and White of New York, who also designed the Boston Public Library, Madison Square Garden, and Penn Station. And actually, if we look real close here, this group surrounding the bandstand is actually listening to a concert by John Philip Sousa. Next, I'm going to talk about these small vertical tick marks you will see around the top of the court. These were the 90 Star Maidens by Sterling Calder that looked down from the top of the curving cornices. While petite in appearance, each maiden was actually about 14 feet tall, and 60 small Nova gems adorned her crown. In this court, two 95-foot-tall columns stood at the radius points of the arcs, the columns of the rising and setting sun. Each was topped by a winged figure by Adolf Weinmann. The rising sun was... Actually, I think that's the setting sun. I thought it was the rising sun. Well, the rising sun was a heroic male with outstretched arms, while descending night depicted a lovely woman with wings half furled and her face delicately shielded by her hands. A 31-foot section of each of these columns was made of heavy, opalescent fluted glass, which was lit from within. A large glass sphere, also illumined, topped each glowing column. In his book, The City of Domes, author John Barry says, "In the sunken garden, those two shafts rising from the fountains, looking like stone by day, had become great candles, glowing from the base to the glass globe on top." Louis Christian Mulgart created what was officially called the Court of Abundance. However, the architect and much of the public preferred the moniker the Court of Ages, as its decorative program strove to portray the successive epochs of the world's growth. At night, it seemed like the outdoor cathedral of a mysterious religion, with incense urns burning all around with colorful, flickering flames. On the perimeter of its central lagoon, quartets of coiled snakes spat tongues of live flame into steaming braziers. The architect's original design included dual curving staircases and a pipe organ in the main tower. Two smaller organs in towers at right angles to the main tower were to be connected by wires to the large organ, creating an echoing effect. This plan being deemed too expensive, Mulgart substituted a cascade of water in front of the tower, fed by unseen sources and enriched with sculptural representations of sea life, representing the mystery of water. I think that's very pertinent to us this year, isn't it? But this, too, was jettisoned due to cost, but the arcades of the court remained encrusted with sculpted lobsters, crabs, and turtles. In the sculpture program, higher strata showed plants, animals, and humans in a series of progressively more civilized eras. The architecture of the court was variously described as Spanish Gothic, Romanesque, Moorish, Oriental, and French. But writer Ben McComber suggested the style simply be termed Mulgart. Looming east of the central palaces was the vast 9-acre capacity Palace of Machinery by San Franciscan Clarence Ward. This is one of the three naves that ran down its long axis. Each was 968 feet long, nearly 1,000 feet. And this was all made of wood. The palace's configuration was loosely based on ancient Roman baths or thermae, particularly the great baths of Caracalla. On December 30th, 1913, Lincoln Beachey flew his airplane through the palace in what was the world's first indoor flight. The sole PPIE building remaining on its site is our beloved Palace of Fine Arts, but it still has some interesting secrets to tell. On August 1912, the Architectural Commission reviewed early plans for all of the palaces. They were particularly impressed with the lovely charcoal sketches of the Palace of Fine Arts, and they congratulated Willis Polk on its design. Willis Polk. Polk, however, said the drawings were by Bernard Maybeck, and that Maybeck ought to be engaged to finish the design, with which the commission agreed wholeheartedly. The palace cost about $630,000 to construct, and the elegiac character of the building was said to have been inspired by Arnold Böcklin's painting The Isle of the Dead. On its site was an existing brackish pond, which was regarded as a nuisance. Willis Polk called it a mud hole, until Maybeck transmuted it into an asset, the Palace of Fine Arts Lagoon. The curved gallery portion of the palace was one of the few structures at the fair built of steel, but not for structural reasons, but rather because of the fire protection requirements for all the wonderful international art that was to be housed within. Lastly, the South Gardens featured two domed buildings, here and here, set like cabochon jewels within an exquisite brooch. On the western side of the South Gardens stood the extravagant Palace of Horticulture. It was designed by local architect Arthur Brown of Bakewell and Brown, who also created San Francisco City Hall. Its layout was based on the Blue Mosque in Istanbul, and some likened it to a giant opal. I call it an Ottoman mosque cast in iridescent turquoise glass, then dipped into a fondue of French ornament. The other building cited in the South Garden was the Festival Hall by Robert Farquhar of Los Angeles, another graduate of the École des Beaux-Arts. He had also studied at Harvard and MIT. To me, this unremittingly French-styled Beaux-Arts building always seems somewhat out of place at the PPIE. Inside, its 4,000-seat auditorium housed this huge new organ by the Austin Organ Company, and many prominent organists of the day entertained throughout 1915. Next, we'll examine the other design elements that were suffused over the entire grounds of the fair. The color plan was novel. Chicago's Columbian Exposition of 1893 was popularly termed, what? The White City, very good. And subsequent large fairs had largely conformed to its precedent, although there were some small experiments in architectural color. But, as official PPIE historian Frank Morton Todd writes, quote, no white city would have been tolerable in the ardent California sun. But the PPIE's director of color, well-known illustrator Jules Guérin, envisioned a city of ivory and, quote, warm oriental hues, not garish as dead white would be in the strong California sunshine. So he pretty much agrees with Polk. In addition to ivory, his color schema included gray, golden orange, oxidized copper green, cerulean blue, and three tones of Pompeian red. Every area of the exposition was required to conform to his palette, right down to the guards' uniforms. The bottoms of the pools were painted blue. The murals, flags, and floral plantings reflected Guérin's color choices, and even the road surfaces were treated with a roasted beach sand to create a pinkish color. The sculptural program of the exposition grounds was tremendously important, and it, too, had been considered from the earliest moments of the fair's design. The chief of sculpture was Carl Bitter, located in New York. But Sterling Calder moved to San Francisco to become the acting chief of sculpture. And he designed the Star Maidens. Most of the statuary was of the same ivory shade of faux travertine as the palaces, but those works that were near the viewer were of a simulated bronze likened to the color of blue eucalyptus. So who knew that the end of the trail was actually eucalyptus green. Statues that were far away and freestanding were golden in hue. Many of the figures were huge. For instance, the sculptural groups atop the two triumphal arches were 41 feet tall. These colossal works started as much smaller maquettes designed by the master sculptors of the day, including Calder, Robert Aitken, Daniel Chester French, and James Earl Fraser. Next, a large wooden armature was created, then plaster and clay were built up and checked with a large pointing machine called a sculpto-point until the results were satisfactory. A sculptor could reproduce up to 1,000 points a day using the pointing machine. Without it, it would have been about 300 points a day. Sunset magazine said, "Painting derricks are hoisting the exposition sculpture into place. Angels and goddesses and fairies, artisans, explorers, and pioneers are taking their places on pedestals and in niches, overlooking roof and garden and spreading green lawn besides the greater spread of the blue bay." John McLaren, the famous superintendent of Golden Gate Park, was enlisted as chief of landscape and worked closely with the architects to achieve stunning effects. Here are some of the greenhouses he built in the Presidio to nurture exposition plants. More than 1 million bulbs were planted. The flowers in the parterres were changed 3 times over the course of the exposition and were, of course, coordinated with Jules Garand's color plants. Another notable feature of the grounds was the immense hedge fence of ice plant that ran for 4 city blocks from the Fillmore Street gate to the Scott Street main entrance of the fair seen here. Now, this lantern slide is of other interest because this is opening day and all these little gray dots are people. This is over 250,000 individuals. And this was not the highest attendance day at the fair. As a matter of fact, it's about the 4th highest. But really what we're interested in here is this wall, which is of living plants. Ice plant was first grown flat in 6-foot by 2-foot by 2-inch deep boxes and then affixed to a vertical framework. The hedge was 8 feet thick and 20 feet high, and rose into 36-foot-tall arches at the main entrance of the fair. Visitors to the fair were often skeptical that the many mature trees on the grounds had not stood there for decades. McLaren had grown tall eucalypti and acacias from seedlings, especially for the fair. Venerable cypresses, orange, and palm trees were gathered from all over California, then side-boxed a year in advance, and finally moved to the grounds. Historian Frank Morton Todd said of the skeptics, "Visitors who could not believe that the great palms and eucalyptus trees surrounding the exposition palaces were transplanted had to be told gently and firmly that the bay had covered the whole central portion of the site when construction began, especially where some of the largest trees stood. Some believed, but many lacked faith." Now, I'm going to talk about the lighting. I did a 100-page master's thesis on it, and you're going to get about 5 slides. After incandescent bulbs were invented in 1877 by Thomas Edison, electric light appeared on a small scale and in individual exhibits at fairs. The World's Columbian Exposition of 1893 in Chicago was the first fair to incorporate electric light as part of the fair's design. However, the PPIE was the first exposition that planned a total comprehensive illumination plan before ground was even broken. Walter Darcy Ryan of General Electric was appointed chief of illumination, and his spectacular designs included that of the Tower of Jewels, the Great Scintillator, and the Electric Kaleidoscope in the Palace of Horticulture. Here is Ryan's description of a great scintillator show. Quote, you take up a position anywhere on the marina or North Gardens and you wait for the signal gun. Over 2,600,000,000 projected candle power will simultaneously burst forth from the great scintillator located on the miniature Moro Castle at the entrance of the yacht harbor, forming an aurora borealis which will reach from the Golden Gate to Sausalito and will extend for miles in each direction. You will see wonderful Scotch plaids in the sky, and you are sure to be impressed by the weird ghost dance or the spooks parade of the beams. The north facades of the exposition will be illuminated in ever-changing colors. Alcatraz and the Marin Hills will come in for their share of the attention. Unquote. Now, Ryan also invented a device called the electric kaleidoscope to project effects onto the inside of the dome of the Palace of Horticulture. The electric kaleidoscope was a device comprising 12 projector spotlights. These spotlights shone through a color screen, then onto one of 5 composite lenses, allowing patterns to be evenly dispersed over the interior of the dome with no abrupt demarcations. Ryan called this effect the nebular hypothesis. And while he was enthusiastic about the electric kaleidoscope during the planning phases, he was unhappy with the final result. He wrote, quote, the glass in the dome of the Palace of Horticulture was not in accordance with my specifications. The results, while generally satisfactory, could not come up to anticipations due to the lack of sufficient diffusion in the glass. So although Ryan was not pleased with the final results, his opinion does not seem to have been shared by the public at large, who rhapsodized over the effect. The Examiner wrote, last night, a little group of engineers on the exposition grounds saw a book of blueprints and a yard of calculus blossom into a mammoth bouquet, a sidereal system, a march of planets through the heavens, a sunset diffused into a beryl sea, an aurora borealis, and a pageant of sun, moon, and stars. Because that's how they wrote in newspapers in 1915. In 1915, the standard for lighting was called outline lighting, where lines of tiny bulbs were mounted on buildings. This is the ferry building in 1915. Does this look familiar to anyone? It looks like the ferry building in 2015. That amazing effect, which will be up until December 4th, this year, was enabled by the wonderful Donna Ewald Huggins, who raised the funds and found a steeplejack who would go out on the ferry building and put up all these lights. So I suggest you go see it at night before December 4th. Ryan popularized indirect lighting at the PPIE, which changed the standard of architectural lighting from this forever. Before 1915, there had been isolated experiments with indirect lighting, which is what we would now call flood lighting. But the standard remained outline lighting. For the PPIE, Ryan designed these lovely banner standards, hung with heavy cloth on 3 sides and decorated with heraldic shields of early Pacific explorers. And behind each banner was a group of lights that washed the surfaces of the palaces with even light. And you'll note that every little flag or piece of sculpture here is lit. This was achieved via what Ryan called a mosquito fleet of tiny spotlights mounted on the tops of the opposing palaces, each focused on an individual decoration. In closing, let me remind you of Willis Polk's 1891 sketch of an imagined San Francisco World's Fair. Now let's look at what was actually built. Ah, pretty amazing, huh? Well, the PPIE was not the largest in attendance of all American World's Fair. I honestly do not believe that any such completely realized, fully curated Beaux-Arts ensemble of similar size has ever been realized at any time. I'd like to thank again the Commonwealth Club for hosting me, and I hope that you, the audience, has enjoyed your introduction to the design, color, and lighting of the 1915 World's Fair. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much, Laura, for that great and illuminating presentation.
Oh.
And now we'd be happy to take a few questions from the audience.
Who paid for all this?
That is ever the question, isn't it? Well, the funding for this massive effort, you know, it was reimagined just 9 months after the earthquake and fire, reincorporated, because they felt that this would make San Francisco, in the eyes of the world, appear to no longer be a pile of ruins, but rather a fully functioning city again. So they held an auction on the floor of the Merchants Exchange that raised $4.089 million in less than 2 hours. That was an unprecedented effort. At the time, San Francisco was battling New Orleans for the right to host the fair in a congressional battle, and they raised $1 million. Okay, so we already had $4.089 million, which was later by subscription of individuals raised to $7.5 million. Then San Francisco had a $5 million city bond, and the state paid a $5 million state tax. So now we're up to $17.5 million. And then the concessionaires and the foreign exhibitors and all the exhibitors who had to pay to erect their own exhibits within the palaces paid the balance of what was a $50 million exposition. So that is who paid for it. Next question.
I was curious, with the exception of the Palace of Fine Arts, approximately how long after the exposition ended were all those palaces and everything destroyed?
That's a good question. How long after the fair were the remaining palaces destroyed? Well, unlike the San Diego Fair, also held in 1915, which was built on public land, 90% of this was built on land leased from the owners. And the fair had to return that land in improved condition after the fair. Some of it at the end of 1916 by contract, some by the middle of 1917. A few isolated structures were left. The great Column of Progress, which we can barely see the top of here, the Palace of Fine Arts, and the California Building, largely because they lay on Presidio lands. And there was an Oregon building that looked like a giant fir tree Parthenon. And some of the foreign structures, they were left up because those were on public lands or on governmental lands. So basically, everything was either knocked down or purchased and moved somewhere else by the end of 1916 or the mid-1917.
Among all those architects, did Julia Morgan ever get a chance to do anything? Julia Morgan?
Yes, so she asked, did Julia Morgan ever get a chance to do anything? Julia Morgan is a total favorite of mine, and I have some very exciting possible Julia Morgan leads. However, for this fair, Julia Morgan designed the interior of the YWCA building. This was part of the early portion of her long association with YWCA designs. And it is highly likely that she designed what was called the Girls' Clubhouse on the Zone, which was the midway of the fair. So the women that worked in the Zone attractions, so diving girls and cowgirls and Japanese maidens that served tea in cafes and all sorts of women, generally lived in little hovels behind the attractions. And some of them had apartments, but not all of them. And so a few months into the fair, the concessionaires agreed to pay for a little clubhouse under one of the roller coaster tracks. And I believe Julia Morgan designed it. I have researched it extensively, and we have no proof yet. I am still working on it. But at this clubhouse, the girls could take a hot shower or a bath or get a meal for 17 cents, which was a good deal even at the exposition, or simply sit and read or be quiet or sew. And so we believe that that is a Morgan structure. I have a few pictures of the interior, and it does look like a Morgan design. Thank you. Any other questions?
Again.
Besides the Palace of Fine Arts, are there any other buildings that remain that were perhaps moved? And my second question is that there's rubble along the breakwater on the Marina Green that I'm told is remnants from the destruction of the fair buildings. And you can see when the tide goes out architectural elements, and I'm wondering if that is in fact true, what that material is there, and if you know about that.
Okay, for the first question is what's left of the buildings that were moved? And the answer is kind of multifaceted. The buildings that were really knocked down, it was an architectural yard sale. You could buy a window, or you could buy piping, or you could buy a plant, or an urn, or a bench, and people did. And they were signing up as early as October 1915 to buy these things. And so there are lots of little bits, and often people will come and tell me, my aunt has a lamppost, you know, things like that. So there are lots of little bits basically going back to the earth all over the Bay Area. This site, PPIE100.org, which is the site to learn about events, it's sponsored by the California Historical Society, and it's aggregated all of the public events that have to do with the PPIE this year. So, for instance, you'll see all of my public lectures, but then you'll also see all these amazing lectures and events by other people. And my calendar itself is filling up with other stuff that I have to go see because I'm learning new stuff about this fair. There on the site also is a wonderful pamphlet in PDF form called After the Lights Went Out. And it was researched by my friend Glenn Koch. And I believe some of the graphic design was done by this woman named Zoe Heimdall. Oh, wait, she's sitting right there. Raise your hand. There you go. Who also has a wonderful site, sanfranciscomemories.com. Anyway, but you can download After the Lights Went Out, and it traces the locations of some of the larger buildings and artifacts left from the fair. Okay? Oh, and the seawall. That was built in 1895 by the Comstock Lode Baron James G. Fair. And people say, oh, it's made of earthquake rubble and things like that. No. There apparently are some bits of statuary in there. I'm not sure if those are from the 1890s. I personally consider it very unlikely that they're from 1915 because virtually all of the major sculpture was made of plaster and hemp and steel armatures. There's no way it could have lasted. So, but I have heard that there's like a face that you can see at low tide. Yeah. Well, it was built in the 1890s, so they could have come from other places over the city. Maybe one or two more, and then those of you who have books, I'll sign them, or I think the Commonwealth has books that I can sign. One or two more? Back here?
Yeah, thank you. For those of you who are also Julia Morgan fans, you can visit Berkeley, and the Berkeley City Club is right next to the campus and is a beautiful example of her work. And it features a restaurant called Julia's.
And I may be speaking there later this year. I hope so. All right, shall we call it? All right, thank you so much for being a great audience. I really appreciate it.
Our thanks again to Laura Ackley for that wonderful presentation. We also thank our audience here at the club, as well as those listening on the radio or online. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, held during its 113th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.